Argue about the science of climate change all you like, but when you live in a place where fires or floods or both have become more common, it behooves you to begin preparing differently for what may come. That is the basic message of a new book on preparing for the effects of climate change, co-written by a couple of former staffers in the Obama administration. The book is called Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. The authors are Alice C. Hill and Leonardo Martinez Diaz. Both worked for the Obama administration in energy and environment and resilience roles. Alice is now a senior fellow for climate change policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Leonardo directs the Sustainable Finance Center at the World Resources Institute, and Leonardo is our guest. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks very much for having me, Jeffrey.
So neither of you really comes to this from a climate background. How did you end up getting to the subject of the book?
Well, that's one of the interesting things about the book and our path to this. We're not environmentalists. We did not have a science background. Alice, my co-author, is a lawyer, and she was a judge for many years. Then she came into the national security space when she joined the Department of Homeland Security. I myself was an academic. I worked in finance and economics. And I think both of us, in our different ways, began to see how the changing climate is beginning to affect things way beyond the environmental space. It's beginning to affect things like national security, the way we grow and maintain our food supplies, and our economies and our financial system. So I think without looking for it deliberately, we stumbled upon the enormity of this challenge, and now we have decided to devote the next phase of our careers to it.
You listed national security first on there, and in fact, you start with an example of the provisions that the federal government has to make now because of threats to security infrastructure. What's happening at Norfolk, Virginia?
Yes, the military, above all, has a huge mission, of course, which is to prepare and fight wars. Ultimately, for them, it's all about practicality. How do you move materiel and men and women around the world? How do you get ready for any contingency that's necessary? And how do you prepare for military action? And so they don't have the luxury of debating the science. They have to deal with reality as it is, and they have to use the best available information. So for them, in places like Norfolk, which is a major military hub, the largest naval base in the world, and the place where we build our nuclear submarines, our aircraft carriers, and where we have thousands of men and women in uniform, this has come home. The idea that climate change is beginning to affect, for example, how they prepare for naval operations and how they're able to move people back and forth from work has become a problem because Norfolk is sinking, the land is sinking, and at the same time that sea level rise, which is exacerbated by climate change, it means that flooding has become a real problem in Norfolk. And over time, that flooding could jeopardize major roads and major transportation links. If you can't get your folks to the base, you can't get them to work, you can't get them ready, then we have a very serious problem. That's why the military has been concerned about climate change for quite a while now. And they continue to work very diligently on how to get around this challenge.
And to make the facilities resilient for what may come. So you point out in the book that resilience can mean a lot of things. I mean, what's the sense that you're bringing to it here?
Well, we use the term resilience to mean the capacity of a community to reduce, absorb, and recover from the impacts of climate change. So let me break that down. Reduce. We want to be able to ensure that when a community or a company or a city is hit by an impact, that the risks are, we can reduce some of those risks. Maybe we can help avoid some of the losses by putting people on safer ground or by retrofitting some of our buildings to make sure they can reduce some of those losses. Now, absorb is also important. Once we get hit with one of these impacts, is the community able to take that hit and then be able to get back to normal from it? And then recover, of course, is very important. In some places, we won't be able to reduce all the losses. We won't be able to avoid all the risks. So when we do get hit and sustain damage, can that community snap back into some degree of normality? And so those three things are crucial to our definition of resilience. And I think from a practical standpoint, it means for mayors and business people and households, it means how to think through what the threat is and how do I prepare for it in very practical ways.
You give a wide range of potential actions that would be called for in cases of resilience, beginning with the no-regret choices. How would you define those?
Sure. A lot of folks tell us, look, climate change is a long-term phenomenon. It's complicated. It's uncertain. We don't know for sure precisely how temperatures are going to rise. We only know they are going to rise, but we don't know how quickly. We don't know necessarily how that is going to affect a specific location around the country. And so people ask us, well, how do we plan with all of these uncertainties, all of these complexities? How do you decide if you decide to shell out a lot of money today for a protection that might not be required or needed later on? How do you make those decisions? One of the ways to think through this is so-called no regrets measures. That is to say, to put in place a measure that makes you better off today and that preserves flexibility for tomorrow. So when you build, for example, a bridge, you don't know precisely how high the sea level rise will go, but what you do is put in place some features of the design that allow you to raise that bridge later on at lower cost, should you have to do that. So can we put in place little features of design in our infrastructure, for example, that will preserve options later on in case our projections turn out to be wrong and we actually need to elevate things or change things in a way that helps us cope with what comes later.
You say, Leonardo, that you've tried not to speak in terms of catastrophe or apocalypse, but is it somewhat difficult at times?
Absolutely. It's, we're facing a very significant challenge. A lot of the things that climate change will bring are things we have not seen before. We've seen, of course, record fires in Northern California. 2017 was the first year ever when three Category 4 hurricanes made landfall in the United States. You know, nobody could have predicted that weird twist that Hurricane Sandy took that drove it into New Jersey and New York for the first time in recorded history. So there's all these new things that we are seeing that are certainly scary. But what we tried to do in the book is to say, look, the challenge is enormous, but we have to figure out how do we practically address it. There are things we can do now that will help reduce some of the damage, that will help make sure that we transition to a world that is more resilient. But we have to start now. And we cannot do that if we are feeling powerless or if we feel that there's nothing that can be done to address the challenge. Of course, we have to reduce our emissions. We're very clear about that at the beginning of the book. Long term, there is no better solution that to limit climate change than to cut the amount of greenhouse gases we put up in the atmosphere. But at the same time, we have and can do things that will make our farming, our cities, our communities more resilient to impacts that may already be baked into the system.
All right, so follow the pathway of the book and reduce greenhouse gases at the same time. So the book begins with where and how to build, rethinking where and how to build. And some examples here. How did Hurricane Andrew change Florida and how it approaches building?
We look at what we call no more moments in the book. That is to say, situations where a disaster is so severe that a community decides no more. We want to take measures now to make sure this type of thing doesn't happen again. There are a few examples in the book. We talk about, including Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Harvey that hit the city of Houston in 2017, but also examples abroad, flooding in the Netherlands in the 1950s. All of these were these types of disasters that led to solidarity and a kind of a community commitment to a no more mentality. And those are the kinds of, that's the kind of coming together that we need to be able to address this challenge. In many places, what happens after a major event is people look at how we build, meaning what are the rules that are in place that help direct where we put things, housing, commercial infrastructure, and roads and bridges and so on. How do we make sure that they are put in place and built in a way that will make them resilient to the future's climate, not yesterday's. For example, in Texas after Hurricane Harvey, there was a shift in thinking. Before, the idea was very, very low, very permissive building codes. Let everybody build almost wherever they want very quickly so you can incentivize growth. But then after Harvey dumped 50 inches of rain in a few hours, you know, people realized we got to change this. And so then the city of Houston put in place some of the most stringent building codes in the country. Florida is going through the same process. They're seeing sunny day flooding. They're seeing very severe impact. And the city of Miami, of course, is waking up to this reality. It's no longer a partisan issue in Miami. You had a, we talk in the book about a Republican mayor of Miami who decided to throw his weight behind a major initiative to protect the city. And so I think folks in these states that are the front line of climate impact are starting to understand that this has to be a bipartisan issue or a nonpartisan issue and to put in place new rules for how we build.
But politics still enter the process, don't they? I mean, the fact is, even when people get to know more moments and say, okay, that's it, we're going to build differently from now on, there was some backtracking in building codes in Florida. And as you point out, after some changes to flood federal flood programs in the Obama administration, didn't Donald Trump undo some of those after Harvey?
Yes, ironically, something called the Federal Flood Standard was repealed by the current administration just 10 days before Hurricane Harvey hit Texas. So I think it's pretty clear that when you remove rules and you take things away that would make us more resilient, we all become more and more vulnerable. And there's no question about it. Once you put in place these rules, some of them will cost some folks money, right? Transition is always costly to some different groups. So, for example, there may be some in the building industry and in real estate that are concerned, and rightly so, that some of these changes will cost some money, that they will require change in the way things are done in business as usual. But I think what we have to do is to ensure that we are helping manage that transition, that we are also thinking about the cost of doing nothing, right? It's not just about the cost today of getting building resilience. It's you have to weigh that against the cost of doing nothing, and those are much bigger than the cost of prevention.
We're talking to Leonardo Martinez-Diaz about the book he co-wrote with Alice Hill called Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. Let me try that again. How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. I wanted to ask, though, about, this issue of where to build and where not to build, ultimately. I mean, if you're in a place that's prone to fires or floods, ultimately you may decide, let's not build, at least in the same way there anymore. How hard a psychological barrier is that, though, especially when people use the word retreat to attach to it?
We're going to have a very soul-searching conversation as a country, and even at the local level, about which areas are no longer defensible from an economic standpoint. Some will be threatened by sea level rise, others by perennial wildfires, and we're going to have to think about whether it's safe for communities to stay in one place. Already we've seen some examples in Louisiana and Alaska of villages that have to relocate altogether because they are at risk of falling into the sea, literally, getting overtaken by sea level rise. But that is still very expensive. It is understandably a lot of folks are tied to their location by culture, by history, by family and friends. And so we have to be able to figure out how do we enter into a process where we can facilitate that movement of people ahead of time. If we don't do it in an organized manner, we're going to see things like what we saw after the Hurricane Katrina, where 1 million people were forcibly displaced by the hurricane. You had 250,000 show up in Houston in a very haphazard way, had to go through a lot of difficult times to find any livelihood. Very disruptive, caused a lot of suffering. But if we can do this in a gradual, more planned way and help folks find safer places, we should be able to spare a lot of this disruption.
You mentioned, Leonardo, villages in Alaska dealing with rising waters and collapsing permafrost and things like that. In fact, the second chapter of the book is called Lawyer Up. There was a village in Alaska, Kivalina, that went to court. Against who and for what?
Well, the community of Kivalina is suing for the damages they see have been caused by climate change, and they're essentially seeking compensation for some of those damages. And Kivalina is not alone. There are many other communities in the U.S. and even abroad that are trying to figure out who is going to pay for what they see as damages that have been imposed on them through no fault of their own. We're going to see the entire sort of court system, I think, over time, try to figure out the answer to this question of who pays the costs of climate change. And because our system is so based on law and the court system, I think very interesting responses are likely to come from the courts. It will take a while, but I think what it will mean is that we are all going to have to be a lot more sensitive to who bears responsibility for decisions, right? So when engineers and architects and corporate board members make decisions about all manner of economic activity and where to build things and how to design things, they're going to have to think about climate change. Because if they don't, it's possible that judges and juries down the line may find them guilty of negligent by ignoring risks they should have known about. And while right now this might seem like a novel legal idea, this is the type of thinking that has led over time to shifting ideas of what are you responsible for as a decision maker and what should you have known better about. And it's very likely that climate risk is one of those things.
You do get to legal action in the children's climate suits, including the Kelsey Giuliani case from Oregon. But is there any sign that the threat of such suits is producing more action, either from governments or from fossil fuel companies?
Well, there's two kinds of litigation. One is the litigation in which, like Giuliani, where young people are looking for, they're essentially trying to get the government to take action against climate change. And they are suing the government for what they see as, rightly see as inaction, insufficient action from government. That does not look very good right now, to be honest. There's a lot of litigation of this type, but it could be a while before that litigation bears fruit, if ever. But there's a second kind of litigation that we talk about in the book, which is insurance companies and communities and businesses suing one another, trying to recover costs for damages from climate change, and trying to figure out who should pay in a very sort of specific way for damages. And so that second type of litigation is likely to move much quicker, and is likely to get to the headlines. Even though right now what's very much getting covered in the media is the lawsuits against Exxon and the other big oil companies.
Now these are all civil suits we're talking about, but there are some criminal actions you guys recommend. Have there been some?
Well, we look at a case in France where the local authorities were extremely negligent about protecting their community from flooding. And in the end, a flood wound up killing several people. And a criminal investigation was started, and there was, these folks went to jail. So the prospect, again, that people who were in positions of power and authority and should have known better about potential risks and did nothing, could now be even liable for a criminal, not just civil charges. There's cases, for example, involving nursing homes and hospices, even prisons that are becoming extremely hot because of rising temperatures in the United States. And if people die as a result of those heat waves, when people should have known that this is now a likelier possibility because of climate change, are those criminal charges as well? That's a question that we'll see more and more of.
We're talking to Leonardo Martinez-Diaz here on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Alice Hill are the co-authors of Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. It is not directly about greenhouse gases, but it is about the things that we need to do aside from greenhouse gas emission reductions to make sure that we can get through the things that the climate throws at us in the years ahead. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.com. climatechange.org. And here is an email that reads, "Hey, I'm Wolf from California. I've seen climate change hurting people all over the world, like farmers in Nepal and India. Permaculture is a design process to conserve resources and create an ecosystem instead of just looking at property as a house and a landscape. Eco-villages are the perfect way to solve housing and adapt to climate change together." That from Wolf in California. What do you think, Leonardo?
Well, I think the overall point here is that because of the way our communities have evolved, we've forgotten largely where our food comes from, our connection to the natural world, where the water comes from when we open the tap. And as a result, we've sort of become oblivious to the fact that we are actually hugely vulnerable to shifts in climate and in the water system, the food production system, the natural world, the fisheries, for example, in the Pacific Northwest. And now climate change is reminding us that actually we are embedded in this ecological system, that we're a part of it, and that we all need to start thinking about the implications climate will have for the rest of the system. So any activities that involve us coming closer to that understanding that we are part of these cycles, and getting everybody to become more aware and to remember in a way that the ecosystem and our modern economy are one and the same thing. Anything like that will be quite helpful to getting us to action.
Let's move into your strong suit, the finance and markets, because there's a whole chapter in the book about making markets work for resilience. Who's Mark Carney and what's the tragedy of the horizon he referred to?
So Carney's a Canadian official who was the head of the Central Bank of Canada. And then later on in his career, he was appointed to head the Central Bank of the UK in London. And what made him both famous and controversial in some places is that he was one of the first central bankers, if not the first, to argue that climate change represents a risk to the financial system. That unless we start thinking about the long term, and he argued correctly that financial markets tend to be very short-sighted. They tend to think in months and sometimes even years, but not very many, 5 or 10 years max. Unless we think longer than that, we are at risk of ignoring this this problem altogether. That's what he called the tragedy of the horizon. We got to think beyond short-term time horizons and get a grip on this problem. And ever since he gave that speech in 2015, the financial community has really taken his ideas on board. And now you begin to see all around the world people in the financial markets trying to understand better how to manage those risks. And even the Federal Reserve Bank here in the United States is starting to discuss the importance of getting a grip on what climate change might mean for our financial system.
So people are obviously thinking in terms of what the solutions or options of the future might be, but then they also run into politics. And there's a story in here about the National Flood Insurance Program where things were not doing so well. Congress passed a fix, and then things got more interesting still. What happened there?
So the National Flood Insurance Program is a program through which the federal government insures many homes in the United States against flood. Back in the 60s, a lot of the private insurers decided to exit the market because they saw this market as too risky. And as a result, the government had to step in and provide that insurance itself. That has been obviously very helpful for homeowners who were unable to buy insurance in the private market. But what it has done over time is that it now insures a portion of homes that are actually very risky and ultimately keeps rebuilding those homes as they are damaged by flooding. And ultimately that goes on taxpayer account. And that is a problem because the more the flooding problem gets worse, and unless we change the system, we're just incentivizing folks to stay in the same place, not take action to become more resilient, because they know the government will bail them out. And so that's a challenge that's going to grow in cost over time.
And probably the part of the book that's going to give people the most heebie-jeebies, the subject, the very subject of paying for resilience. I mean, when we're talking about things like taxes, is this a bridge too far for a lot of people still, Leonardo?
Well, taxes are never popular, of course. And so when we figure out that we need to pay for resilience measures, politicians and leaders are going to have to make a compelling case that taxes ought to go up to pay for some of that. And so you've seen that already in places like Miami, where, as I mentioned earlier, a Republican mayor took up the charge of passing a referendum that would raise taxes so the city could borrow $400 million in so-called Miami Forever bonds that could help protect the city from flooding. In San Francisco, you've seen similar measures, raising hundreds of millions of dollars for protection of the coast. And we're going to see similar, I think, efforts in other states and cities to raise more money for resilience. Ultimately, what's important is to point out that resilience is much more cost-effective than paying for the damage after that. There's been a number of studies showing that for every dollar of resilience that we spend, we can save $6, $8, and as many as $12. Depending on the sector in which you're investing. So the cost-benefit is clearly positive. It makes a lot of sense to invest in prevention today. But the question will remain how to raise that money. There's other ways besides taxation. There's, for example, the use of proceeds from carbon taxes and cap-and-trade systems that could be used to pay for this. There's something called value capture, in which you basically try to work with the local communities to share the costs with the private sector. So there's other ways to pay for it. It's not just taxes, but we are going to have to think as a country about how to raise significant new resources for investments that really make a lot of sense.
Now, the section on paying for resilience is in a whole part of the book called Tools for the Decision Maker, and the next tool there is get the data and make them usable. There's so much data out there about climate change. What data are you talking about, and who needs it the most?
Sure. Well, today we collect more weather and climate data than we ever have in history. Just think that NOAA, one of our key agencies in the federal government, collects every day the equivalent of 8,300 Netflix videos, and that's just every day one agency. And this data is collected from satellites and a variety of sensors, and it has to do with, it's about environmental change, weather, temperatures, moisture, cloud cover, et cetera, right? And this data is hugely valuable because if you can translate it correctly, it can be useful for folks on the ground. It can help farmers figure out what to plant, when to plant it, and where to plant it. It can help businesses figure out which supply chains are at greatest risk. It can help homeowners when deciding where to buy a house in terms of the exposure to natural disasters. So this data is literally life-saving and will be crucial for good decision-making. The problem is there's a ton of it, and oftentimes it needs to be both translated and made decision useful. And that requires a process in the middle there for government or the private sector to bring it to our desktops in a way that that people can use at the business level or in households or in government. And we have to be able to do this cheaply and in a user-friendly way. Sure, big corporations can absorb a lot of this data and make sense of it. But small businesses, local governments, we quote a few of them in the book, they have a lot more trouble with that. They need much cheaper access, and they need access in a way that doesn't require a PhD to make sense of it. So that is going to be crucial, and it's a role for both government and business to play together.
As you point out in the book, though, psychologist Daniel Kahneman once said, no one ever made a decision because of a number. They need a story. So, I mean, who then would take the data that you're talking about making available and make it into a story that would be compelling enough for people to take action?
Well, in the book, we portray a number of different people across our communities who are doing this role, who are playing this role. It could be a risk officer in a corporate board meeting, trying to make the case to his colleagues or her colleagues that that they need to invest in resilience. And so that person has to be able to use some of this data to tell a story about how the business will be affected if resilience is not put in place, right? It's about a mayor, for example, telling his or her community that they need to build a seawall, or they need to think about local planning in a different way. And they need to tell that story using the data, but then translating it into something that a narrative that people can understand and hopefully vote for. So this type of translation, as we call it in the book, from big sophisticated data into decisions based on stories that people can understand will be taking place across the country, inside companies, in city town halls, in schools and communities across the country.
And then, of course, there's a huge chapter in the book about, well, hugely important, I should say, it's not that long, but about working with human nature and the issues of trying to convince people of things which they are skeptical of in a lot of cases. And you focus on Cape Town, South Africa, which was approaching what it called day zero in water. How did it avoid day zero?
Well, in South Africa, Cape Town faced a major crisis. The water reservoirs were running very, very low, and the city was at risk of literally running out of water. It would have been the first time that a major city was basically running the taps dry. And so the local government put in place a variety of what's often called nudges, basically framing tools and other techniques to try to get people to focus. So, for example, they did this was very unpopular at the time, but it was effective. They started to help report and put online the water consumption of specific households. It was not the names and people did not appear, of course, but you could see on the map which properties were consuming a lot of water versus others, right?
Water shaming, some people have called that.
Basically, yes. And so this was an emergency situation, so they used basically every tool in the book to try to get folks to cut back. And in the end, they were able to reduce water consumption very drastically. This is not a long-term solution. Cape Town still has to do some serious long-term planning about its water consumption. But our point here was there are certain ways of framing things, certain ways of both rewarding people by praising those who behave in a responsible way and to shame those who are, frankly, engaging in irresponsible ways to try to help shape people's behavior. And it has been shown to work in other areas, but we think it can be applied to resilience as well.
Well, but then you get examples in here like Hoboken, New Jersey, right across the Hudson River from Manhattan in New York, and the city got federal funding to help it build flood walls. And what happened?
Well, folks were very concerned that the seawalls and all of the protective infrastructure was going to spoil their property values because it would block some of the views of the sea, and it would be very sort of unsightly and ugly, ugly stuff. While that was certainly true, the longer-term perspective, of course, is that this infrastructure is literally going to save your property from destruction and flooding later on. The problem is that as human beings, we tend to put more weight on the losses, especially if they're staring us in the face, and we weigh that more heavily than benefits that might come later, even if those benefits are a lot bigger, right? So the mayor of Hoboken, Don Zimmer, she had to convince her people that this was a good idea, and that even though this infrastructure might be, not the best looking, that it would be good long term for the community. And they also try to figure out ways to make it less damaging to property value. So they put some, garden infrastructure and some murals and try to make things look a lot better. And in the end, she was able to convince the community to take the federal money and put these retrofits in place. So that's the type of, small town debate and discussion that will have to happen. And this is the sort of dilemma that mayors across the country are going to have to face.
you know, massaging the message to make sure that it's palatable and understandable to the greatest number of people. Now, even if all that works well, you have the situation that you get to the book about inequality of resilience. The fact is that some places just are lower, more prone to floods, or drier, more prone to fires. I mean, it just is distributed unevenly, which does create things like climate refugees. We have receiver countries that struggle already with compassion for refugees. Politicians, as in Italy, win elections by slamming the door. What will it take to open that door?
Well, this is perhaps one of the most challenging chapters in the book in terms of what it means for us. We're looking at two things. One is, how do we focus on protecting the most vulnerable first? We look, for example, at heat waves. During a heat wave, those folks that are statistically more likely to die are those who are isolated, those who are alone, living alone, who don't have a support network, who live in communities that are not well integrated, oftentimes people of color, minorities, the elderly. And so those folks, we have to come up with a system to ensure that they are looked after, even if they live in places where they might be more isolated. There's a famous book about the heat wave in Chicago in 1995 that contrasted two different neighborhoods, very similar demographics, but in one, a lot of people died, in another, things were much better. And the main difference was this idea of social connectedness. People were checking on each other in the neighborhood where the death toll was much lower. And so we need to use technology, we need to use other forms of public communication to protect those folks first. The other issue is, how do we deploy our resilience money, right, in a way that doesn't make inequality worse? I once asked a New York city planner, you know, how would you deploy your resilience dollars? And he said, well, we just wanted to avoid losses. We would put all of our money to protect lower Manhattan, because that's where the wealth is. That's where the big buildings are and the big banks and all that. But if you did that, of course, you'd be pulling money from the rest of the city and pulling it away from other communities, poorer communities. They may not have as many assets, valuable assets to protect, but they have a lot of people in them. So we need to have a conversation about how to deploy these dollars in a way that is equitable and doesn't just protect the islands where all the wealth is located.
Do we actually have those conversations, Leonardo, though, or do we wait for disaster? I mean, are those people who are making $12,000 a year in Norfolk in a very low-lying area going to get moved out or otherwise protected before something bad happens?
Well, we don't have a great track record of doing this, but the climate justice movement and others that are beginning to have been shining a light on inequality in other areas, in housing, in education, in public transportation, all of those folks have to now come together around the climate challenge, because this is going to exacerbate inequality in all of these different spaces. So if together we can bring those who care about climate change with those who care about social justice and care about protecting poor communities, we should be able to come up with a much stronger political voice, as well as better ways of having this conversation in a way that's inclusive and hopefully leads to better outcomes.
It is a book of pragmatism. Is there also optimism here, or is that still guarded?
What we're basically saying is we got to start now, and we have to take these steps today. If we don't, the cost will be enormous, and the transition, we're going to adapt either way, right? People are an adaptive species, but the adaptation will be far more abrupt and painful unless we start doing it now. And so we are optimistic that we will get the message, but we are also realistic that we need to start today, and that will start in very small but very measurable ways.
Leonardo Martinez Diaz directs the Sustainable Finance Center at the World Resources Institute. Alice Hill is a senior fellow for climate change policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. They both worked in the Obama administration on energy and environment and resilience roles. They are the co-authors of Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. Leonardo, thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Thanks for being here.